Hi, and welcome to Om Filosofisk Liv och Tankar, a podcast where we discuss philosophy with current philosophers. My name is Signe Savén, and I'm a PhD student in practical philosophy here at Lund University. And by my side, I have
Matti Jansson, senior lecturer in theoretical philosophy at Lund University. And with us in the studio today, we have Mariana Laventi, a PhD student in practical philosophy at the Department of Philosophy in Lund University. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Alexander Velishkov, recently a PhD student at the department, now a PhD in practical philosophy. Welcome.
Hello.
So, welcome. You are both part of a project called Lund Gothenburg Responsibility Project. Could you tell us a bit more about what this project is?
Is everyone looking at me? Okay, then I will. Well, it's, I think, as far as we know, the biggest or top three, maybe, well, one of the biggest projects in philosophy in the world that is devoted just to studying issues relating to moral responsibility and agency.
So what is responsibility?
Well, we've been trying to figure that out for close to 10 years now. I don't know where to begin. Mariana.
I mean, I think it's important to have the distinction between what we talk about when we talk about responsibility and what other people talk about. So if I say I'm responsible for my daughter, I signal a duty, I signal have something I have to do. But when we investigate responsibility, we talk about blame, praise, how we react to certain wrongs or harms. So it's a little bit different from what people might think that responsibility is about, but still connects with everyday assumptions about how we should behave.
So it's essentially a moral concept.
Yeah, we study it, and we study moral responsibility. So there's causal responsibility, how, you know, what causes things, and we talk about that to some extent. There's legal responsibility, but we talk about that to some extent too, but our main focus is on moral responsibility. So as Mariana said, praise and blame taken as moral concepts.
Could you help our listeners distinguish between sort of the concept of causal responsibility and moral responsibility?
Do you want to go? Should I?
You can go.
Okay. Yeah, so causal responsibility would be, I think it's easiest with examples. So you say something like, the rain is responsible for the puddles, on the classic philosopher's example. So the rain is responsible for the puddles on the ground. And that would be causal responsibility. So rain is a cause of the puddles. And that's not what we're talking about. When we talk about moral responsibility, we say something like, this person is responsible for a harmful act, something like blameworthy for a bad act.
It would be mistaken to blame the rain for the puddles,
exactly,
for instance.
Or morally blame. Yeah. In English, sometimes you say, I blame the weather for this. But
for the puddles.
Yeah. But we, although that's a linguistic thing, we distinguish between the moral concept.
So what are the implications of being responsible? Blame is one thing. Are there other implications?
There are many. How we view the world, how we treat wrongdoers, how we understand each other. So it's a very basic human concept, not only moral. How we have to see others, how we treat children or other people. It's very important, and I think it's an integral part of everyday life. And we try to understand how it works. We have tried for a long time, and still we have a few unanswered questions.
What can you say about how it works? Where have you gotten so far? What are the main theories or ideas or accounts?
There are many, I think.
Yeah, I can give a go at this one.
Are there any that are particularly popular within the project?
Yeah. So a big idea is that blame and praise are essentially connected to human emotions, what we call the reactive attitudes. So think of anger when it's directed at other people, guilt when it's directed to you, that's in the blame case, or admiration or pride, for example. That those would be the positive correlates. So a very influential and important idea is that whatever else is going on in moral responsibility, emotions seem to play a major role, especially these emotions. These are emotions that are directed towards human agency. They're very special social moral emotions in that sense. And that's quite popular in our project too. So we talk a lot about these emotions, their nature, their normativity.
So emotions on the part of a person holding someone responsible or for being responsible, or where does the... Can you give an example of how emotions enter into an account of responsibility?
Yeah, so one way we approach this question is, question of what it is to be responsible is to say that to hold someone responsible is to have, or for it to be fitting or appropriate to have certain emotions towards them. So if Signe knocks over my glass of water, and then I would hold her responsible in part by feeling angry or disappointed, for instance. And she should feel guilty and ashamed and many other terrible things.
And yeah, and what does that should mean?
That's a difficult one. So big part of our project is figuring out the normativity of emotions and how does that come in. But there seems to be something about... So not everyone in philosophy agrees on this, but it feels like there is normativity of emotions. Our emotions can be correct or incorrect. We're still not sure what makes an emotion correct, but there seems to be something like a fit between an emotion and an object. So for example, it feels like correct to fear a dangerous object, like a dangerous dog, and incorrect to fear like a oversized bunny or something like that.
Depending on size.
If it's a... exactly. Yeah, okay. But, okay, a bunny. Well, why did I even...
Why go with oversized?
I was thinking people might be confused about the dangerousness of a big bunny, but it's still as harmless as a normal-sized bunny. Anyways. Of course, depending on the size. Okay. But my point is we seem to be able to criticize people based on certain wrong emotions. And it's a big task in the responsibility literature to figure out what would be the normativity of these particular emotions. So anger, shame, guilt, and so on.
What are some other important concepts in this area?
Many. Quality of will, what kind of regard we have for others. Like if you knock Alex's cup and he instantly thinks that, oh no, Signe did that because he hates me. Seems that he doesn't have very good quality of will towards you. He thinks that he's attacked. Or he could feel, oh, Signe accidentally did this. It seems that he has some kind of better regard for what you do. The same for you. You might do this on purpose, so you have some kind of bad quality of will towards Alex. Or you might be by accident.
Mm. What about free will? What if I have to knock over his cup in some sense?
Great question. I think free will has been a very big issue on like the responsibility literature for so many years. Like if free will and determinism, the idea that everything is predestined by previous events, can be compatible with each other. So if everything is written in stone beforehand, how can I have free will? I think that in the latest years we have tried to move away from the free will problem, especially because we cannot really agree on anything because we don't know and we speculate. And I think a big change was when Freedom and Resentment, like a very influential paper by P.F. Strawson, came out and tried to move aside the free will problem and focus more on interactions, everyday interactions about responsibility, and say that these are important issues that we should talk about, not the free will problem.
So I can maybe jump in very quickly to say that that connects to what Mariana said about quality of will. So one way in which people try to sidestep the free will debate is to say, listen, it only matters what kind of quality of will you had. If you knocked my glass over on purpose, who cares if you did it because you were causally determined by some physical laws or something. You acted badly. You're like a bad person. And that's everything we need for these emotions to be fitting. I'm angry at people who are, what's a nice word for this? Bad people. And it would be incorrect if you did it by accident. And that has nothing to do with causal determinism. It's really about what kind of agent you are. And that's one way to sidestep issues about free will. We don't agree it's fully successful, but yeah.
So is it that you kind of make responsibility independent of the free will debate? Like you can be responsible even if you have, in one sense of it, no free will.
Yeah.
What about blame? Can you, does that also come apart from whether or not you have free will, or is the situation slightly different there? Do I deserve to be blamed if I couldn't have acted differently?
I mean, although we try to sidestep the debate, I think the debate follows us. So issues like control, was I fully in control of what I've done? Issues like how I was raised, like I cannot help being raised in the way I was raised. So am I truly free to pick the things I have picked in my life? Issues of how free I was at the moment. We are restricted by our everyday humanity. So it's quite difficult to say that free will doesn't play a role, or like the general concept of what is to be a free agent, a free responsible agent. So in many ways, the free will thing comes back to bite us. But I think it's in a more... In a way that we can actually research it a little bit in depth and emphasize more on like the human interactions instead of some kind of metaphysical out there idea that somewhere exists free will or something like that.
I got the impression that one way to sidestep the issue of free will is to sort of... gauge the appropriateness of an action in terms of attitudes or feelings of a person who performed the action. But isn't there a risk there as well to sort of making the action less important? Because if I were a person that intentionally knocks people's glass of water over regularly, then maybe doing so would sort of be the bad of me, but being that person is also a bad thing. So is there any risk for losing grip of the actual actions that we hold people responsible for when we try to sidestep sort of a question of free will?
Can you say it again? So why would, is it action versus character, or
yeah, something like that?
And then your thought is that
maybe by trying to sidestep the question of free will, does character get too much of room in debate of responsibility?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. I've never thought about it in this way, because it feels like actions and characters are both causally determined. I mean, my character is, in a sense, outside of my ultimate control. It's based on my genes and environment. And I might change my character consciously, but the method for changing my character is also causally determined. So in a way, I think that both actions and characters and intentions, all of those things are equally causally determined. Yeah.
But I'm just thinking that if I'm bothered by determinism, when there's this intuition that, well, if your behavior is sort of predetermined, I can't really hold you responsible for it. There was nothing you can do about sort of carrying out that action. And it sounded like the way to go around that is to say, well, it's still the case that your action was carried out for a particular purpose or with particular intentions and so on, and having those intentions or carrying out an action with those intentions is a bad thing, and I should hold you responsible and blame you given a particular configuration of intentions and emotions. But then it seems that the action itself is not sort of the root of the problem, but sort of the disposition of a person carrying it out. Or I guess it's worse to knock people's glasses of water over regularly than just being disposed to do it and not doing it. But that was a thought anyway.
How does luck relate to this, if we're in this deterministic world?
Oh, wow. Well, so that's one thing that quality of will can't save us from, worries about luck. So even if we say, you should be angry at bad people, you should praise and admire good people, you should feel pride, proud of your achievements, it feels like, we have everything we need for a good life. But then when we start thinking about how life actually works, we see that luck plays a huge, giant role in our lives and the way we perform our actions. And so it feels like life is a lot more tragic and difficult if we admit that luck plays a role. So just one example. Imagine something that I very often use as an example, because my chapter one of my thesis is on this. Imagine psychopaths. So a psychopath is someone who performs evil actions, does bad things, does really horrible things because they don't have a capacity for empathy. So they go around doing really terrible things. But they were unlucky because they were born with, a subset of what we call psychopaths were born with a disability to be better. So they're incredibly unlucky, and yet we get angry and mad at them for all of their bad actions. And the problem with luck is that we seem to care about this because we have intuitions about fairness. We think that it's unfair to, for example, react negatively to a psychopath, put them in jail and, shout at them being like, you psycho, and make them feel bad and suffer and all of that, because they are in a way handicapped. They're like incapacitated by birth.
So just to map it up a bit more clearly, perhaps. So would you say that the psychopath is responsible but not worthy of blame?
Would I say that? I would say no. I say that they are worthy, and then we get to the really deep issue. So I would say that it would be appropriate to have all the negative emotions that I mentioned towards them: anger, resentment, disappointment, contempt, and so on. Because they are bad people, and that's what our emotions seem to track. But on the other hand, we have an intuition of fairness, which tells us that they shouldn't suffer for this. And then we have a conflict. We want to react negatively, but it's unfair to do so. And I think that conflict should just be accepted. So in a way, they are blameworthy in that sense, that they merit these emotions. In another sense, they're not, because they don't deserve to be treated badly. And that's what it is like to be human.
And chapter one of his thesis.
And I think, maybe it's chapter two, actually. Didn't count the introduction.
It's been a while since,
exactly.
And speaking of that, would you want to tell us a bit more about what you're working on personally?
No. So what I have been working the last years is something that I call the victim's perspective, which is an idea that I try to develop more as a perspectival switch. So as reading through philosophy and the moral responsibility debate in general, I thought that this does not speak for me. I don't agree with many things. And when I don't agree with many things, I usually fail to understand them deeply. So I thought that something is missing, something that needs to be done. And I thought that, yeah, we always talk about these things like quality of will, like we talk about psychopaths, we talk about capacities of humans to be responsible, but we don't really talk about the victim. So I thought that we have been writing this part of philosophy from the wrongdoer's perspective for a long time. We talk about fairness for the wrongdoer, but what about the fairness for the victim? And that's what I'm trying to establish as my philosophical account and investigate more how we can talk about the victims inside the moral responsibility debate.
I think that sounds super interesting. What have you come to find out about that so far?
It's not a very popular idea. For me, it feels intuitive and self-evident that, yeah, we should talk about the victim. And even though it's unfair for the perpetrator sometimes to be punished or to compensate the victim, it's also unfair that the victim is harmed to begin with. And I feel that we should prioritize victims, not the fairness for the perpetrators. And I found out that a lot of our very classical issues in the literature do not account for that and do not really think that that's important. But I believe it is. And yeah, I'm pushing this. I'm not going to let it go.
How does this map out or like map into what Alex was saying before about like with respect to psychopaths, it being appropriate to have all these reactive attitudes, but also like not fair to punish them necessarily? Like, could having all these attitudes be kind of having the victim's perspective? Like, the victim is in one sense a person who should have those attitudes. Is there like an overlap there, or is it just me?
I mean, we work in the same office, so it was inevitable that some of us would have similar ideas. I think we are very influenced by Matt Albert. So we have this idea that, yeah, both can be true at the same time. Like, something can be unfair, but it needs to be done in some sense. I see it from the perspective of the victim that, yeah, this is unfair for the perpetrator, but it needs to be done. The victim needs to be acknowledged and compensated. And I think, like, in some sense, my account is the continuation of the reconciliation that Alex is trying to propose in his thesis. So in some sense, I think that we agree in many things.
I think Mariana has very interesting thoughts on, let me know if you agree that your thoughts are interesting, on the value of protest. Maybe that's one way to frame it. That regardless of fairness and so on, there's just great value in protesting actions that are wrong. So just saying, no, you can't do this. This is wrong. This is horrible. This is inhuman. And we need to do that. And it's very important for the victim. Maybe you want to say more?
Yeah. I use the idea of moral protest as a way to have some kind of reaction that victims can use when they're blamed. Not when they're blamed, but when they're harmed or hurt in some way, and they don't really want to engage with their wrongdoers for their own reasons, but they still want to say this was wrong. So if you have an uncle who is being disrespectful to you in the, I don't know, Christmas dinner, and you really don't want to fight him again because you have been fighting him so many years and you just want to have a nice dinner and let this go. You don't have to. You don't have to. You're not, I want to suggest that you're not like being disrespectful to the other people that he is insulting. But you can talk to your friends. You can protest his behavior later without actually having to talk to him, without having to call him out or do something like blaming him in his face. That would be also like a psychological burden for you. So my accounts usually have this kind of, how can we help the victims navigate the life after or before victimhood? Like, how can we make this a better place and how we can give them better tools to navigate these situations?
Could you expand on that a bit more? Maybe give some examples?
Moral protest is an example. My account of blame is also an example that I think that when you blame somebody, you demand them to acknowledge you or to compensate you in some sense, or to help you out after they've done something wrong. Sometimes I believe, and that's fair, even in cases that you didn't mean to. So if I am late to our date, because, I don't know, the bus broke down, there was a tornado, things erupted around me, then I still feel that if you waited for half an hour for me, I should say, oh, I'm so sorry. And I think this is a natural human reaction. It was not my fault, but I'm so sorry you were late. I was late and you have to wait for me. And I feel that's how we can navigate life, being like a little bit more graceful and kind with each other. Actually saying that, yeah, sometimes it's unfair, but it happens. I have to do it. And sometimes I can feel guilty for things that were out of my control.
Can I just follow up on the interesting concept of moral protest? Yeah. So I sort of see how there can be moral protest without blame. But is the other way around possible too? Can there be blame without moral protest?
I think so. Most accounts of protest are accounts of blame. So blame as a way of protest as a way of blame. So I think so, like not actually talking at all about it could be blame because you're silently blaming the person, but you're not actually voicing anything. So you're not really protesting.
Okay, so part of protesting is sort of verbally making it explicit.
That's what I suggest, that you have to talk to somebody about it, like have some kind of sanity check that, oh, my uncle was inappropriate. Don't you agree? Yes, I agree. Because sometimes you kind of need it after you have, you know, silently agreed with everything he said. You might need somebody to say, yeah, that was inappropriate. That shouldn't happen.
Right. So even though you didn't get the sort of acknowledgement from the perpetrator, you get something from a friend or from...
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, yeah, sometimes like political protests work like that. The people who are responsible for the protest are not ready to listen, but other bystanders maybe are ready to understand and listen what's going on. Like with Black Lives Matter, it was very difficult to convince people that don't want to be convinced. But I think there were a lot of people who are not aware that this is a thing, that some people are treated differently. And I think that was important for them to know.
What about your recent dissertation? What is that about?
Well, what's that whole thing about? Well, it's called Responsibility and Ambivalence. And the basic thought there is that, okay, let's see. My whole starting point is that it feels like in philosophy we tend to, because we are so interested in building a theory, and a theory of a particular kind, so we want a theory that's going to give us a clear, easy, resolute answer. So a theory that's internally consistent and that admits of no internal tensions. So because of this, of a pursuit of this kind of theory, we want to give unambivalent answers. So psychopaths are blameworthy, you know, you have free will or you don't, and so on. Just clear, easy answers. And my whole thesis is to explore the thought that, no, it's much of our lives are involve a state of tension. So we feel ambivalent when, for example, to stick with the example, when we face psychopaths, we get extremely mad at them. At the same time, we see it's unfair that they need to suffer for this. And we just need to live with this tension, which in my thesis, I call ambivalence.
I see. And so it's sort of an unresolvable tension in one way. There's no way out by sort of saying, well, certain psychopaths are blameworthy, but others are not.
Well, the ones that are developmentally incapacitated, yeah. For them, the tension will, if you're honest and aware of all the facts and can appreciate them and so on, you will have a practical tension. And whatever you choose to do, you know, react negatively or not react negatively, in that sense, you will resolve the tension because you have to act. You're going to do one thing or the other. But you have to live out the tension. And you know that something bad or wrong has happened, whatever you do. And that's something that philosophers tend to overlook in ethics, that we very often make these choices which leave us with a not an optimal state of affairs, that something was sacrificed on the way.
Or a form of idealization.
Yeah.
Away from...
That's human life, though. I think that's a turn, like, recently, that we go to a more humane and, like, actually understandable philosophy instead of being in two polar opposites. We're not seeing black and white anymore. We see, like, they're in between. There are things that, yes, sometimes you have very bad choices and you have to choose the one you can live with or choose the one that right now seems less bad. And later you can find out that, no, it was worse than the other one. And I think that is a part that Alex's dissertation does really well, to actually say that this is part of our human nature. Sometimes we sacrifice things and sometimes the sacrifice will not pay off. But that's human life and we should just accept it. It's a very good idea, if I can say so.
I think so too, yeah.
What do you think are the main purpose of these practices? Holding someone responsible, blaming someone?
For me, in how I use it and how I understand it, it's a way to help people. Sometimes we have very established ways of going around. We have very, like, stable social practices. But we still have some kind of feelings of, this is not very fair, but this is the way things done. And I think that blaming people and actually investigating and blaming practices can tell us a lot about how the social affairs are now and how we would like them to be. So I feel that there is still in philosophy a kind of idealization that all people have the same rights and the same capacities and the same responsibility and the same part of life. But in real life, you see that this is not the case. Like, we are very different. We have a lot of things that are going on. And sometimes the variables are so many that you cannot even think about them. I think what we try now to map out is, like, a way to understand more about how we blame each other and what this means for us.
I can maybe add that out of, I don't know, 40, 50, 60 years of research now on this, one idea that's definitely taken hold is that the practices, Signe, that you mentioned, of holding responsible, have a lot to do with communication. So that seems to be a big part of it. So when I blame you, I want to communicate something. I signal something. When I apologize, I want to communicate, signal something. So it's all of these emotions, guilt and anger, shame, they communicate things about us. They say things. And so these responsibility practices, they're almost like another kind of language. So we use them to say in a way or express in a way what we think about each other as people.
I think that's very interesting. I'm thinking also, is there something there about signaling about ourselves as people?
Yeah.
Like when you did this, I felt this in that way because I would have needed this from the situation instead. I think when we spoke about this previously, you spoke about it in terms of like restoring balance. Could you say something about that here as well? I thought that was an interesting thought.
Which one of us said it?
I think that was Mariana, actually.
it's part of my account. I'm sorry.
No, you go then. I was like, oh, damn, I don't remember saying anything like that. I have to improvise. It's you, Mariana.
But I don't know, it's me. So in my account, and I emphasize my account because there are other accounts that say other things, just to clarify.
Not as good, though.
Yeah, obviously. but in my account, I think that when something has been done, when some kind of wrong has been done to a victim, then we need some kind of chains to restore the moral balance, because the victim carries that that burden of the harm that shows that, oh, it's open party for that person to get harmed like this again. And if we don't rebalance their moral worth, then we let the victim being re-victimized or even like having to live with that burden. So in that sense, maybe that the perpetrator feels guilty, it's a way to signal that he did something wrong, she did something wrong, they did something wrong. So it's a way to signal that this was wrong. You don't carry the burden of what I did. It was me that I did this to you. It has nothing to do with you. I did it. And I feel bad about it. And maybe I feel bad as you felt bad when I harmed you. Maybe I feel less bad, but it depends on the situation. It's some kind of moral acknowledgement of, oopsie, I did something wrong and I hurt you. Like, I'm sorry. I feel bad about this.
But I assume that moral protest is also partly about restoring balance, or sort of hearing from someone else that what a perpetrator did to you was, according to them, wrong. Yeah. So it sort of has also.
Yeah. It's part of how I view the world, that sometimes things are taken away from you, and it's going to happen because this is how life works, but you can find ways to take that back through other people, through community, through people that have been through the same experiences as you, and you can make that work. You don't have to carry that burden alone, and you don't have to carry that burden forever.
And speaking of guilt, that reminds me of something you spoke about before, Alex. You saying something along the lines of being interested in continuing doing research on guilt.
Yeah, okay. So my idea about guilt that I explored and that I'm still exploring is that the standard assumption in philosophy, but also for most people, is that guilt is fitting. We go back to that normative notion that it's somehow correct only if you've done something wrong, only if you're at fault for something. And that pretty much everyone accepts this. You know, you're guilty if you're blameworthy, if you did something wrong. But I'm now exploring the idea, and I think there's a good case to be made for this, that guilt is a fitting response to some other situations too in which you did nothing wrong. So it's a correct and perfectly understandable emotion, even if you really weren't at fault. And that puts us in a bit of a you know, my favorite thing in a bit of a tragic situation, because then you feel guilty for things that were, in a sense, you couldn't avoid. It's, you got in yourself into a situation in which it's correct for you to feel guilty, but you did nothing wrong. And so to give an example, I think the easiest example is that imagine that our sexist aunt gave...
That's the easiest example?
I think it's quite a clear one, because many people have gone through something like this and they can relate.
We all have a sexist aunt, it's true.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're Eastern European, so we definitely do. right. So imagine that we have a prejudiced sexist aunt that decides to give everything, wills everything to me and nothing to Mariana, or maybe... the example goes, wills like her holiday cottage to me and some porcelain figurines to Mariana.
Not a true story, though.
No, not a true story, but it could happen. We can all imagine happening, it happening. And then the thing is, I did nothing wrong, me personally. It was my aunt who decided that the man should get everything. And yet I feel guilty. I feel like somehow I owe something to Mariana. In this scenario, by the way, we're brother and sister, just so you know. Yeah.
I want that cottage.
Yeah, exactly. And then I feel guilty. And that seems to be the correct emotion there, because guilt, according to philosophers and psychologists, is a sign of submission. It's a way of saying something like, I don't think I deserve more than you. Guilt makes you... kind of almost bow down to the person and be like, I'm sorry, I don't want us to be in this relationship. I don't think I'm anything more than you are, and I'm willing to repair this. Yeah.
So I can get the weekends?
Yeah, you get weekends, I get weekdays.
And in doing so, you're restoring the balance somewhat.
I think Alex is restoring the balance somehow. Maybe me asking him, you know, this is quite unfair. Can we find a solution between us? Could also be a way to restore the balance. So it's not really that he wronged me, but he's like a third party that would try to help me navigate the injustice that I have suffered. So in that sense, like, yeah, he's restoring the balance. Well done, Alex.
Do you think we can achieve that, restoring the balance, without having this talk about wrongness, badness, and blame?
I mean, you can say that something that happened you didn't like. I think we do that in human relationships all the time, that maybe what you did was not wrong. Precisely, it was not bad. But it hurt me, and you didn't know, or whatever. And I think then it makes sense that if the other person wants to help you or want to restore the relationship, even though they have done nothing wrong, like objectively, they want to help and navigate, even apologize to help you. But I think that shows like a commitment to the relationship and a want to actually help the other person and empathize and understand the other person's needs.
Just sort of, we need to round off. For those of our listeners who want to read something great about responsibility, what would you recommend them?
So Responsibility and Ambivalence by Alexander Velichkov. I think it's absolutely amazing.
That goes without saying.
Yeah, available online.
I think they wanted something great.
No, but that's. am I stuttering? I said it quite expressly. No.
Maybe work outside of a project.
Mariana?
Is Strawson paper a good place to...
Well, Strawson's paper is quite important. Yeah, so P.F. Strawson's 1962 Freedom and Resentment. Let's see, David Shoemaker's 2015 Responsibility from the Margins. Also great, explicit,
Matt Albert. Although we said outside the project, but still, like... I'll mention him, yeah. He has an introduction to moral responsibility. It's a very short and very well-written book.
Excellent book, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a great way to get you started in more responsibility.
Thank you. And thank you both for coming and talking about moral responsibility with us.
Thank you. Thanks so much for inviting us.
Yes, thank you. And thank you, Peter, for handling the sound here in Larmstudion.